The real American Revolution, President John Adams once noted, began in the hearts and minds of the American people. And with that quote from our nation's second president, we welcome you once again to the history of the Catholic Church in the United States, this time to the early national period of U.S. history. You may recall we said last time that the era of the American Revolution took in a great deal more than just the years of the fighting of the Revolution. It took in 26 years of history. Well, in much the same way, the early national years of American history will take in a few decades also. And by common agreement of historians, the early national period would begin with the inauguration of our first president, George Washington, in 1789, and it would conclude with the inauguration of our seventh president, Andrew Jackson, in 1829. So roughly it's taking in the administration of our first six presidents, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and John Quincy Adams. This was a period in our history when you had a tremendous growth in the ideas of rugged individualism, freedom, liberty. People were trying to get away from the old concepts of privileged aristocracy. And it was an extremely optimistic period in our national life because there was a growing feeling, a very uplifting kind of a feeling, that we had thrown off foreign domination. We were an independent nation. We were going it on our own. We didn't have to be bothered with England anymore. We didn't have to be bothered with their so-called antiquated ideas of government. We were now on our own. We were Americans, and we were set and ready to go. Well, Catholics in the United States, of course, were caught up in this nation's optimism, this uplifting kind of a feeling that was so prevalent in those early decades. But something began to go wrong, because many Catholics in that era, taking up this mentality that we had thrown off a foreign power, we had thrown off the old world, we were now a new nation and so forth, took that idea out of the political realm and began to apply it in the spiritual realm. Now, when you start to apply it in the spiritual realm, believe me, such an idea is wrought with difficulties. And we would have a tremendous number of difficulties in the church domestically as we come into the early national years of our life. The difficulties centered around the concept of lay trusteeism. Many of our parishes, not all, but many of our parishes in those days were governed by elected bodies of lay trustees. Laymen who were elected to take care of the temporalities of the church. We know the concept of parish councils today. Well, parish councils are nothing new. They have their historical antecedents in these lay trustees of the early 19th century. One can only hope that the parish councils of today don't experience the difficulties of the lay trustees of a few hundred years ago. But lay trusteeism was the problem, and it was the problem in this sense. In 1821, to give an example, the lay trustees of St. Mary's Church in Philadelphia wrote this, and we quote them, "We oppose being compelled as heretofore to receive, to pay, and to obey priests who are a disgrace to our religion, to us, to themselves, and to those who sent them." German Catholics at Holy Trinity Parish in Philadelphia and German Catholics in the city of Baltimore were insistent through the voices of the lay trustees of their parish that only German sermons be preached in their churches, and if a priest came in and attempted to preach in English, that priest should not be allowed to come into the church. Irish trustees in Norfolk, Virginia, made it very clear that they would rather be governed by a bishop who was a schismatic than by a bishop who was of French descent. At St. Peter's Church on Barclay Street in New York City, New York City's oldest Catholic church, southeast corner of Barclay and Church, you can visit it today, lay trusteeism became a problem as early as 1785. The church was very poor. Largely it was immigrants who went to St. Peter's on Barclay Street, and as a result the church was in dire financial straits and had to declare bankruptcy. So the trustees made a decision that they were going to declare bankruptcy, but they didn't know how the Diocese of New York would look upon it. And the lay trustees at St. Peter's Church on Barclay Street said that if they were going to get any problem from the Bishop of New York for declaring bankruptcy, they would, and I quote them, horsewhip the bishop, close quotes. Well, they did anything but horsewhip the bishop. The bishop was Bishop Dubois, and he removed the lay trustees who were the cause of the problem, and he replaced them with his own, and he sent a message to the congregation at St. Peter's. Episcopal authority, said Bishop Dubois, comes from above, not from below. And he cautioned the lay trustees that they really and truly, if they were Catholics, should obey their bishops. We can learn so much, can we not, from the lessons of history? Well, certainly the most famous episode of lay trusteeism occurred in the early 1820s in the city of Philadelphia, once again at St. Mary's Church on 4th Street. And it involved a rather colorful figure by the name of William Hogan. Father William Hogan was the pastor of St. Mary's Church on 4th Street in Philadelphia, very flamboyant character, very well known on the social scene in Philadelphia. Led a marvelous life, not necessarily all that priestly a life, but nonetheless he lived a very, very comfortable life in his own residence, in his own home. The Bishop of Philadelphia at the time was a man by the name of Henry Conwell, and Conwell did not like the lifestyle that Father Hogan was leading, and so he got in touch with Father Hogan, and he said, "I am respectfully requesting you to move from your residence to the rectory of St. Mary's Church." Father Hogan said to the bishop, "I'm going to do absolutely nothing of the sort." The bishop decided to excommunicate Father Hogan, and the excommunication meant very, very little to Hogan. Hogan remained living in his own residence. He remained going to St. Mary's for Mass each and every day, and he continued, as far as many of the parishioners were concerned, very much with their blessing as their pastor. Well, what we refer to now in history as the Hogan Schism came to the forefront in 1822. The lay trustees of St. Mary's Church in Philadelphia decided they were going to hold an election. The election was between the incumbents, those who supported Father Hogan, and a newer slate of candidates for the job who were beginning to consider or beginning to think that Father Hogan was really not all that right, and in point of fact, he might be a troublemaker. So they conducted a regular election. They had pamphleteering and they had oratory, and if you believe it, they actually had a fight on 4th Street in front of St. Mary's Church between the two factions, a regular brawl, regular fist fight between the factions supporting Hogan and the factions opposing Hogan. Election day came, the slate which supported Father William Hogan won the election, and it seemed as though the bishop was defeated. Until a letter arrived addressed to the trustees from Pope Pius VII in Rome. And Pope Pius VII said in no uncertain terms that he was very, very disheartened with their attitude on appointing pastors and dismissing pastors. He said, "I'm very disheartened with your attitude as regards your bishop. I'm very disheartened with your attitude that you think you own the church property and no one else owns it. In fact, in your whole conduct as Catholic lay people," said Pope Pius VII, "I am very disheartened." What the trustees of Old St. Mary's did not know was that Pope Pius VII also wrote an additional letter to the Bishop of Baltimore. Baltimore was the premier see. The Bishop of Baltimore was the titular head, if you will, of the hierarchy in the United States. And Pope Pius VII let the Bishop of Baltimore know in no uncertain terms he did not like what was going on with the action of these lay trustees at St. Mary's in Philadelphia. And he said to the Bishop of Baltimore, "Do whatever you have to do to curb the power of the trustees. If you have to take all their power away from them, you know, by going through the Bishop of Philadelphia to do it, well then take all their power away from them. Strip them of their power if needs be, but make sure that every bishop and every priest in the United States is completely free in the exercise of his parochial ministry." Well, William Hogan could see the handwriting on the wall after all of this had gone on. He realized that he could not remain in Philadelphia much longer because public opinion was very much turning against him. So not only did he leave Philadelphia, he also left the church. He married twice. And what do you think he got into as far as a business? He began to manage a circus. He managed the circus for a few years. Then he decided he was going to go to law school. He became a lawyer, and he became a very prominent lecturer on the anti-Catholic circuit in the United States of America. Very, very sad story in United States Catholic history. The trustees at Old St. Mary's continued to fight Bishop Conwell, but their fight meant very little. In Norfolk, Virginia, in Charleston, South Carolina, the feud continued between trustees and bishops of the diocese. In both of those instances, both in Norfolk and in Charleston, trustees told their bishops that really the Roman Curia, the governing body of the church, doesn't know what's going on in the United States of America. We have come through this national democratic experiment. They're tied to Europe. They don't know anything about the church. They don't know anything about the American mentality. And really, we should not follow their directive. We ought to do what we darn well please in the United States. And very particularly, what these trustees were talking about was the fact that they felt they should be able to say yes or no. They should be able to either accept or reject the appointment of a pastor sent to them by the bishop. Now, any pastor that they would accept would only become their puppet. He would become an agent of the trustees and probably, in the long run, an enemy of the bishop. Needless to say, this sort of thing did not happen, and trustees were overruled time and time again. But what a dangerous, dangerous mental attitude it was that many of these trustees took on in the early days, the early national years of our early life. As we continue now through these decades of the church in the early decades of the 20th, rather the 19th century, we begin to see a phenomenal amount of growth. Do you remember we said that when Baltimore was created, a diocese in 1789, it was the only diocese, Canada to Florida, from the East Coast to the Mississippi? Well, Bishop Carroll knew that couldn't go on forever. So in 1808, through his intervention, his own diocese of Baltimore was raised to an archdiocese, and he had created what we call four suffragan dioceses: New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and Bardstown, Kentucky, which is now part of the Archdiocese of Louisville. But in those days, it was thought that Bardstown would become a great commercial center. Of the bishops appointed to these early sees, we remember two Frenchmen in particular. We remember Jean Chevreau, who became the first bishop of Boston and later became the cardinal archbishop of his native Bordeaux in France. And we remember Benedict Joseph Flaget, the bishop of Bardstown, Kentucky. Both marvelously holy men, imbued with a tremendous French spirituality. Both insightful men, both men of far-ranging planning, and really marvelous men to head these two dioceses in the earliest years of their Catholic lives. Monsignor John Tracy Ellis of the Catholic University of America was for many years Dean of American Catholic Studies, United States Catholic Studies. He looked at these early national years, and he tried to answer the question, well, what was it that made the church grow as successfully as it did? Why did the church prosper as well as it did in the early decades? And Monsignor Ellis gives us four answers, four solutions, if you will. Parochial schools, institutions of charity, the personal council of bishops and priests, and finally the Catholic press. Well, to begin with, parochial schools, Catholic education. There had been no Catholic education in the United States except the schools in Maryland that were conducted by the Jesuits that we mentioned in a previous episode. But that was going to begin to change when Bishop Carroll in 1791 opened Georgetown Academy, what would become Georgetown University on the Potomac. It was opened not exclusively for Catholics. It was open to anyone who could financially attend. The only stipulation in the Georgetown Charter was that the moral conduct of the students who attended Georgetown was subject to, quotes, general and uniform discipline. In point of fact, the first student to enroll in Georgetown was indeed a Roman Catholic. He was the very prominent Judge William Gaston of New Bern, North Carolina. Georgetown was followed by other colleges. Sometime very shortly afterwards, the French Sulpicians arrived in Baltimore, and they began a national seminary at the request of Bishop Carroll. Carroll wrote that all of my hopes are founded on the seminary at Baltimore, and Carroll was not going to be disappointed. By 1829, that seminary had ordained 53 priests, of whom nearly half were native-born Americans. Then, too, after Georgetown, the Jesuits, of course, went on to develop many, many Catholic colleges in the United States. In addition to the work of the Jesuits, we have the work of people like Elizabeth Bailey Seton, a very famous convert to the faith, of whom we'll be speaking of in a later episode. It was Mother Seton and her Sisters of Charity in Emmitsburg, Maryland, that really gave us the first source of teachers for parochial schools in the United States. Mother Seton's Sisters of Charity were joined by communities like the Ursulines, the Visitation Sisters, the Sisters of Nazareth, the Sisters of Loretto, both of whom worked in Bardstown, Kentucky, and of course the Religious of the Sacred Heart, who were begun by that very, very saintly woman, Rose Philippine Duchesne, and who opened a school for Indians at St. Charles, Missouri in 1818. Institutions of charity were Monsignor Ellis's next point. We certainly would have to talk about hospitals and orphanages, and they began to dot the national landscape any time after 1800. You couldn't go to a large city in America and not find Catholic hospitals and orphanages. But there were other ways that we can speak of institutions, or there are other ways we can speak of institutions of charity, besides just buildings. One of the best known and best remembered was that marvelous Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Many of you, I'm sure, remember in your parish churches when you were growing up the existence of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. It was founded in Paris by a wonderful Catholic layman by the name of Frederick Ozanam, spread to the United States. It came first to the old cathedral in St. Louis, Missouri, that famous old cathedral basilica, which today you can still visit under that magnificent gateway arch in St. Louis. In that particular parish church was the first St. Vincent de Paul Society, and from there the society spread to parishes all over the United States. The personal council of bishops and priests was Monsignor Ellis's final, or rather his third point, and certainly that is kind of an obvious thing. The Catholics were, as we shall see, largely an immigrant flock. They needed the advice of priests. They needed the council of men who had been in this country for quite a while. They needed advice on where to go for a job, on where to go to live, all the practical things of life. But there's another way in which we can look at the personal council of priests as regards Catholic people. The personal council of priests was given in the divine tribunal of mercy, which we call the sacrament of penance. That's where the real counseling went on. That's where the real counseling always goes on, when the priest in the person of Christ not only gives the forgiveness of Christ, but also the advice which goes with that wonderful sacrament. We can learn from history, my dear friends. Our forebearers, on any given Saturday of the week, on any given Thursday before First Friday, and on other occasions, were lined and lined and lined to avail themselves of the wonderful sacrament of penance. How much we can learn from history, how much our forebearers can show to us, that the more frequently we receive that wonderful sacrament of penance, the closer we come to Jesus Christ, who is our true friend, the more we receive his grace, the stronger we become, the holier we become. Indeed, we can learn a great lesson from history if we get back to a frequent reception of the sacrament of penance. And Monsignor Ellis's final point for why the church grew as successfully as it did in the late 19th century was through the vehicle of the Catholic press. We had mentioned in our very first episode the work of Father Gabriel Richard in the old Northwest Territory and the fact that he had begun a Catholic newspaper. But the first diocesan Catholic newspaper was also a very interesting story. It was called the United States Catholic Miscellany, and it was published in the 1820s in the Diocese of Charleston, South Carolina. It was very, very well known as a defender of the Catholic faith and an explainer of the Catholic faith. It broke down a lot of illusions that many people in this country had about the foreignness that was Catholicism and about the beliefs and the practices which Catholics had. Now, to understand why the United States Catholic Miscellany was as successful as it was, we have to look at, shall we say, the brains behind the operation. So we come for just a moment to that beautiful port city of Charleston, South Carolina, and to its bishop, its first bishop, a man named John England. John England came from the city of Cork, in the county of Cork in Ireland. He was a priest of the Diocese of Cork. And he and his sister Joanna, who eventually would become the real brains behind the newspaper operation. He and his sister Joanna came to the United States after John England had been appointed the first Bishop of Charleston. The Diocese of Charleston, at the time of Bishop England, took in both of the Carolinas and Georgia. So while he did not have as large a territory, perhaps, as John Carroll did, he certainly had a very large diocese, which he came to administer. The Catholic flock was growing, and the diocese was created in Charleston, and the need early on developed for the presence of first a diocese and then a bishop in the diocese. So over the Englands came, Bishop England and his sister Joanna, and incidentally they are buried together in vaults in St. John the Baptist Cathedral in Charleston. You can visit their tombs to this day. Over they came, and Bishop England, of course, was charged with the administration of the Diocese of Charleston, and he administered it in a very unique way. First of all, he was a missionary. He rode on horseback, probably at breakneck speed, around the Southland through the Carolinas and through Georgia, catechizing, evangelizing, confirming. He opened a Latin school. He opened a school for freed blacks in the city of Charleston. He wrote a catechism, and it was a very well-circulated catechism. It explained the tenets of the Catholic faith to not only Southerners, but to Americans in general very well. He wrote a very lengthy series of letters to a man by the name of John Forsythe. John Forsythe was Secretary of State in the administration of President Martin Van Buren, the nation's eighth president. And Forsythe was looking for a good deal of information on the Catholic Church and what Catholics believed. And very specifically, Forsythe wanted to know, for the benefit of himself, for the benefit of the president, the government, and so forth, he wanted to know what position Catholics held on the institution of slavery. So Bishop England decided to answer the inquiries of Secretary Forsythe with a series of lengthy letters going back into the tradition of the church fathers, biblical pronouncements, events of history, and the like, trying to explain as clearly and as simply as he could to Secretary Forsythe exactly where the Catholic Church stood on the institution of slavery. He was joined by Francis Patrick Kenrick, the Archbishop of Baltimore, in trying to explain slavery. He was also joined by John Hughes, the Bishop of New York. These three gave the most rational explanation of those days, but of the three, probably Bishop England's letters were more popularly circulated around the country. He also had a very unique system of church government in the Diocese of Charleston. He set it up in such a way that you would think it resembled the Congress in Washington, because he set up a bicameral legislative body, the House of Vestry and the House of Lay Delegates. The House of Vestry would be based on an equal number of representatives from each parish of the diocese, and the House of Lay Delegates would be based on proportional representation. In other words, the larger the parish was in the Charleston diocese, the more delegates they would send. And these two houses, this ecclesiastical bicameral legislature, so terribly unique in those days, would meet in Charleston very often. But the bishop did the most prudent thing of all. He kept the veto power. Anything that the House of Lay Delegates voted on, anything the House of Vestry voted on, anything they in combination voted on, if the bishop did not like it, he could just as easily veto it. So you see, while Bishop England appreciated the American democratic experiment, he also knew that legitimate episcopal authority belonged in the hands of the bishop of the diocese. So, these are some of the highlights of the early national years of United States Catholic history. We can conclude on a much more optimistic note. We began on a pessimistic note, telling you about all the problems of the lay trustees. we can now conclude on a much more optimistic note, because the lay trustee abuses were corrected in the person of John England, who balanced Episcopal authority with the American democratic experiment. And that kind of optimism would lay the way for Catholics to proceed even further in Jacksonian America, the episode with which we will concern ourselves in our next program. Thank you very much.